Well, hello and welcome to City Bible Forum and this panel discussion on the topic of forgiveness. Our question for today is, do we need forgiveness? And we have a couple of guests with us. Daniel Midgley is a lecturer, or he teaches linguistics at ECU and also does some teaching at UWA. He has a background. I grew up as a Mormon with a Mormon faith, and now is an atheist, and he'll be talking about his perspective on forgiveness. We also have Nigel Gordon with us, who is a pastor. So he is a Christian and a pastor of a Christian church called Providence Church. He works in West Perth for a corporate advisory company, and we'll be answering this question from his perspective as a Christian. So it's a live question. It's one that's been in the research a lot over the past few years. They've known for a long time. Every single time I see my doctor, she tells me, you know, faith is good for your health, Paul. And we've known that for a while. But something that's emerged since I studied psychology is that forgiveness is good for your health as well. And they've started to do lots of research. There's even, if you Google it, the Forgiveness Institute, which has been at the cutting edge of some of this research into forgiveness, how it's good for your health, why it's good for your health. So we'll engage with that a little bit, but today really is about your questions from the floor. So I'll ask these guys some basic questions, and then it's up to you where the discussion goes, what questions you send in. There's two ways that you can send your questions to the panel. The first is by text. So if you got one of those handouts on your way in, you'll see there on page two, there's a mobile number down the bottom. If you want to submit one of your questions by text, you can do that to this number here. I'll put it up on the screen as well, so you can write it down. You don't have it there in your handouts, put that into your phone now if you want to ask some questions, because that won't remain there. That's going to disappear, that number. But for now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to invite Daniel and Nigel up to the stage, and let's welcome them. Well, it's great to have you guys with us, and I look forward to hearing what you have to say, and feel free to interact with each other's opinions as we go. It's nice to have a smaller panel and a couple of guys who can chat away and discuss the questions that come from our audience. So the question, though, that I'd like to start off with is a basic question. It's, do we need forgiveness? And I might put two questions in together, the first being, do we need forgiveness? The second being, why do you think what you do? Give us some reasons for your thoughts. So I'd like to perhaps start with Nigel, if that's okay, and ask you, Nigel, your opinion on this question.
Sure.
But particularly, why you believe what you do. So do we need forgiveness?
Yep.
Is this microphone working? I don't know if mine's working.
Have you switched mine?
I have.
Beautiful.
We might need to start with Daniel, because mine's not.
It's on.
Is it on? Okay. Well, my short answer to the question is yes, and more than we think. That's my basic starting point. But I thought it might be helpful just to think a bit about the nature of forgiveness as a helpful way to think about it. And my basic definition, and I'm sure Daniel will have his definition, is sort of giving up your right to a debt is at the heart of forgiveness, I think, which I think goes some way to explaining why we often find it so hard to forgive. It's not just, you know, a decision of the will, but actually giving up a debt. In 2003, there was a very popular band in the United States, country band called the Dixie Chicks, and they were at the height of their popularity. And at a concert in London, away from the United States, it was at the height of the hostilities in Iraq, the lead singer said, "We're ashamed that the President of the United States is from Texas." Well, that didn't go down too well back home. And in the course of the next few weeks, the Dixie Chicks received hate mail and death threats, and 270 radio shows in the States banned their music and their albums, and they even had ceremonial burnings of Dixie Chicks CDs. You probably don't remember what CDs are, but they were this earlier form of communication. And in response, the Dixie Chicks wrote this song, which became the head song for an album, and the song was entitled "I'm Not Ready to Make Nice." And the chorus goes something to the effect of, "I'm not ready to make nice, I'm not ready to back down. I'm still mad as hell, and I don't have time to go round and round. And, you know, it's a great song. It was very popular. And she's mad as hell because she feels wronged, I think, you know, that what she said, those 12 words, resulted in death threats and the like. And she felt that a debt, I think, is owed to her. And forgiveness doesn't come easily when that kind of debt is outstanding. So I guess my definition of forgiveness means giving up the right to seek repayment from the one who's harmed you. And Paul mentioned that I'm a Christian, and as Jesus says in the Lord's Prayer, which is a well-known prayer which has been said through the centuries, he uses the language of debt to describe sin. So forgive us our debts as we forgive those who owe us. And if we're wronged, we all know that sense of obligation and wanting someone to pay. Perhaps in the workplace, someone has overlooked you for a promotion and you feel like you have to, you know, that they owe you something, so you might treat them more harshly than you might treat a different colleague. Or who hasn't given a partner the cold shoulder after they have done something that you feel like, you know, they owe you something. Or just holding a grudge, really, is trying to get that debt repaid in a form where someone is paying it. And I think you can't just make nice, if you like, because a debt has to be paid. If someone breaks my mobile phone, if I lend Paul my mobile phone and he's careless with it and smashes the screen and breaks the phone, I can forgive him, the debt can be paid, but that debt doesn't disappear into thin air. I have to go and buy a new expensive phone. I can assure you it's very expensive, Paul. Even if I forgive Paul for that, you know, there is a debt to be paid. And the debt doesn't disappear. Sometimes I might pay it. I absorb that cost in myself. But that's the cost, if you like, of forgiveness, I think. So the second half of your question, though, is do we need it? And I think you only feel like you need forgiveness if you feel like you might have some of those debts owing to other people. Perhaps people you've hurt, or happiness that you've hurt, or peace of mind that people have lost, or relationships or opportunity that people feel like have happened.
I might cut across you there, because we'll come back to you with more questions, but it'll be good to get Daniel's input at this point. And if you want to respond to anything that Nigel said, but the question that I'd like to put to you to start is, do we need forgiveness? And why do you think what you do?
Okay. I don't think that, as an atheist, I want to talk about sin for a little while. I don't think that sin is a real concept. If we mean by sin something that God doesn't want you to do, because if there is no God, then there is no sin. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that we can't do rotten things to hurt other people. That is definitely possible, and it's something that we all need to work for, to not do, to raise our awareness, try to forgive other people if we feel like we would like to, and also make sure that we don't do rotten things. But as far as the concept of sin, I don't think that it's a very good concept. I think it's kind of a backwards, upside-down concept. Let me give you an example with my childhood. I had a great childhood. My parents were very religious, and they loved me, and they did the right thing by me, and I had a really great childhood. But they were very concerned that I would do bad things. I mean, they were concerned that I would do bad things to hurt myself, which, of course, I worry about that for my sons. But they were really inordinately concerned that I would commit sins, that I would, I don't know, go shopping on Sunday, or, you know, look at nudie pictures, or play with myself, or maybe turn gay, or things like that. Things that really don't have anything to do with hurting anyone, but which have a lot to do with breaking the religious rules, or breaking the rules that we're told that a God has given us. Things that are actually really normal to do. And I think that having this concept of sin really set my family up for a lot of unnecessary conflict. I do think that sin has a function, and it's not the kind of function that benefits us. It benefits the religious organization. Because let's say that you're in this system, here we are, we're in the world, and we are told, you are sinful. You have sins because of things you've done. In fact, it doesn't even have to be things you've done. It could actually be things you think. Jesus said, if you, for example, commit lust in your heart, then it's just like you've done adultery. Or if you're angry with someone, that's like killing someone. What a terrible lack of perspective. And so because you are in this situation, oh, and it doesn't even have to be something you do or something you think, it could just be the situation that you're in, the Adam and Eve's sin. To some extent, we are either, you're born with original sin, or you're in this situation and you have a sinful nature because of original sin. So now you're in the game, you've incurred a debt, and you can't get out of it unless you obey the rules. This is not the way to build people who can stand on their own two feet. What this does is it keeps you orbiting in this cycle of guilt, transgression, and then redemption, always orbiting around the organization. This does not help to build solid people. This builds dependent people. And in fact, in Gavin De Becker's book called The Gift of Fear, he talks about a way to recognize violent and abusive people and stay away from them. And one of the things that he says when he's talking about how to notice abusive personalities is something called loan sharking. Loan sharking is when someone offers you their help that you didn't ask for and then says, right, I helped you, now you owe me one. Well, I think this whole idea of sin is a kind of emotional loan sharking. You didn't ask for this help, but I'm giving it anyway. You have Jesus to take care of you. You have Jesus to redeem you from your sins, which aren't based on anything that you actually did. Now you owe me one. I see this as emotional loan sharking, and I think it's not helpful. The way to deal with emotional loan sharks is to say, I didn't ask for your help. I don't accept your help. Get away from me. And I think this is something that we need to do.
To reflect on what both of you have said, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like there is common ground between the two of you that we're rotten or responsible for rottenness, but there's also you can feel guilty about something you're not actually guilty for. So you gave some examples there. So you would say that, yes, we can do rotten things, but often we feel rotten about stuff that only because someone else has told us it's rotten. It's not actually rotten. So you're on common ground that there really is rotten stuff. My second question, which I'll put to you first, Nigel, and then to you, Daniel, is if we do need some kind of forgiveness, or if we need forgiveness, how do we get it? How can we have our debt paid if we need that debt paid?
Yeah. Well, I guess what I was trying to say, and I'm still reflecting what Daniel said, that I do think there is a debt to be paid when a wrong has been done. And you don't always know that you've done a wrong. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. But assuming for the moment there is a debt to be paid, and forgiveness is either that the other person really offering to take that debt in themselves, if you like, there's only really two options. Either you can somehow pay down the debt yourself, so you try to earn someone's forgiveness, you might to a close friend, I'm really, really sorry I broke your phone, what can I do to make it up to you? Can you yourself pay down the debt if they won't forgive you? I think what was alluded to was that sometimes there are things that are so horrible or monstrous that it wouldn't matter what they did, you sort of couldn't make up for it, so that's a problem. Or the other thing is, how to get it would be just to seek mercy, to hope that the other party will offer you forgiveness. You're actually seeking their mercy towards you. You acknowledge that you can't pay the debt. There's nothing you can do to overcome it, and so you seek their mercy. But in that sense, they are, if you buy that line that there is someone always pays the debt, you're depending on the other party to absorb in themselves the cost of that forgiveness, the cost of that debt. So I think that they're the only two options that seem possible to me. Either you somehow pay down the debt, however you achieve that, and or the other person is merciful towards you. And there may be other ways of thinking about it, but I think they're the two broad categories.
Okay, all right. And for you, Daniel, so the question is, how do we get forgiveness?
I think that I kind of agree with what Nigel said, except for the supernatural bits. I think we need to seek forgiveness not from a supernatural being, but from each other. And part of the way that we can do that is by gaining awareness of the things that we do and the consequences of our actions. I mean, for example, we talked about iPhones. I've got an iPhone here, right? And I really like it. It's really good. However, I'm also becoming aware that the people who make our phones might not have things quite as well as we do. So now what can I do? I can't do much myself, but maybe all of us, by reading up about it and becoming aware of the plight of people, maybe making a difference where we can, maybe taking our business elsewhere, maybe by shining a light on injustice and trying to correct it, we can make a difference. Do we know where the things we buy come from? Now, do we try to foresee the consequences of our actions? This is very difficult. It's very difficult to try to become ethical in this kind of sense, and it's much, much harder than getting on your knees and praying. It's much harder to do than that. But I think the important thing is that the metric for what we need to be forgiven of needs to be what's good or bad for people and or for other living things, and gaining awareness that way, and not trying to gain forgiveness based on the arbitrary moral commands of a possibly imaginary being.
Okay. I'd like to ask a question of Nigel to start with, which has to do with this idea of God. You haven't said much about it yet, but my question is, if I owe a debt to someone else, so I break Daniel's iPhone and deprive him of this beautiful technology, how is it that God could forgive that debt? Why would I go to God for forgiveness of that debt if the wrong has been done to Daniel?
Yep. That's a good question. Well, I think maybe just Daniel has filled in some of the gaps of what I haven't necessarily said, but I think at the heart of the Christian story is this idea that God is, if you think of those two options of can I pay down the debt, or is the other person going to be debt forgiving, merciful, I think the heart of the Christian story is that God is merciful, that he offers to forgive debts that we might have towards him. Now, Daniel and I would disagree whether that's possible, but for me, it is possible that I've done wrong, not just towards another person, but towards God, and I think that's what God offers, is forgiveness. I think the Christian story would be sort of a both-and answer, in that Jesus would talk about you do need to seek forgiveness from others, not just from God. It's not as though you live in a world where you're somehow just related to the supernatural but not to the people around you. So you would need to be seeking forgiveness from one another. But it's also true that the way you treat other people, God has a bit, you know, God loves his world. If I'm to mistreat the world or the workers who make my iPhone, for example, God has an interest in protecting their welfare, in seeing justice done. So there is often a sense in which I need to ask forgiveness, not just for the way I might have treated another, but the impact it might have on my relationship with God. So I think the two are interlinked,
Okay. The
horizontal and the vertical.
We haven't talked very much about Jesus yet. I'm just curious as to why you think that God killing his son would actually help to alleviate the debt that we all have. It really seems just very different. I think one comedian said, you know, Jesus died for your sins. What does that even mean? That would be like saying, I hit my foot with a shovel for your mortgage. You know, it doesn't seem to, the two things don't seem to relate at all. Can you tell me more about this?
Well, I think,
why wouldn't God just forgive everyone?
Right. Well, if we take that argument that there has, that debts don't just evaporate, you know, I wish my bank would evaporate my mortgage debt, but, you know, they don't just evaporate, that there has to be, there's a sense of justice that needs to be carried out. So just run with that for the moment. Then there is a price that needs to be paid for forgiveness to be achieved. Either me paying down the debt or someone absorbing in themselves that cost of that debt, then I think at the heart of the, you know, if you, as you would well know, Daniel, as you walk through the story of the Bible from beginning to end, at the heart of sin is really me walking away from God, you know, not wanting to have anything to do with him or his ways, I think is sort of at the heart of the Bible, biblical story. And so in that sense, death is a natural consequence for walking away from God who's given you life. And so there is a natural, it's not as arbitrary as that comedian might have described, I think. Because I think if the consequence for me walking down this path is actually that I walk away from the God of life, then death is an appropriate end to that. It's sort of the natural consequence where I'm heading. And so Jesus' death is, in a way, him taking the natural consequence for what I would have otherwise deserved. So I think there is a more, a greater connection there than what the comedian might suggest.
Are you saying that there's, in the same way as I have a bank debt with money, that there's actually, when I do something wrong, there's an actual numeric or monetary? What is the form of this debt? I understand the money thing. I get that, because we live in a world with money. I don't think that sin is the same as money. I don't think that that there's any kind of actual, like, is God keeping track of how much sin I have so that he'll know how much exactly to pay off? I'm seeing a problem with your metaphor.
Well, I think debt has that advantage of kind of the weight of justice, isn't it? That commensurate payment for wrongdoing. You know, the way our justice system tends to work is that someone receives a judgment which is commensurate to the wrong they've done. So a speeding fine is different to a corporate, you know, stealing, which is different to a murder. You know, there's a commensurate. So I think debt just tries to carry with it that sense of there's a different weights and measures, but there's a commensurate nature to the judgment.
Now, can I ask a question of both of you?
Sure.
Daniel first, then Nigel. Is there anything that's unforgivable, and who determines that it's unforgivable?
That's an interesting question. I mean, there are certainly things that we can do that are beyond our power to repay. For example, murdering someone, what could you do? I mean, you can't do anything to make that better. And unfortunately, that seems to be the world that we live in, where there are actions that we cannot undo. I mean, in another sense, it's not just murder. If there's an offense delivered, we can't undo that offense either. So trying to say that there's some sort of supernatural being that can undo the effects, it doesn't seem to make any sense.
Okay, so you believe that there are some things which will be, you can't repair it, and so in that sense, it might be unforgivable if you can't do anything to fix the situation.
We can't repair the situation to make it back the way it was before. The only thing we can do is to have everyone say, well, I guess I can forgive that person or not.
Same question for you, Nigel. Is there anything that's unforgivable, any actions that are unforgivable, and what makes them that way?
Well, I think to the extent that you feel like someone can never repay that debt that they owe you, for example, there is a sense in which it's unforgivable, isn't it? You know, you can't, I think as Daniel said, your child was taken from you, no one can bring that back, you know, there's that sense. But if it's possible that the other person can bear within themselves that cost, then forgiveness is nonetheless possible. Gladys Staines, who just story comes to mind, was a missionary, an Australian missionary living in India. Her husband and her sons were murdered. But she could forgive the people who'd done that. You know, that it is possible. And I think that the heart of the Christian story is that there is nothing that is beyond God's mercy. You know, that God's ability to and willingness to forgive is not.
What about the sin against the Holy Ghost? Blasphemy against the Holy Ghost is told in the Bible as the unforgivable sin.
Yeah. Let's talk about that over coffee, because I think it's sort of how you read that passage. But I think if you reject God, if you don't want to have anything to do with him, I think my answer would be that's what the unforgivable sin is. You know, God won't make you do what you don't want to do.
I think it's very interesting that the unforgivable sin is unbelief. I mean, murdering someone, doing all kinds of adulteries, that can be forgiven. But the sin of unbelief is the one that can't be forgiven. And there's a reason for that, and that is that if everyone stops believing in a God, that God, well, dies. We don't see that God perpetuating its nature. Human history is littered with dead gods that no one believes in anymore. And so it makes sense that as a method of self-preservation, gods try to prevent the crime of unbelief. I think that unbelief is wonderful, though.
This is a related question on what Daniel was just talking about. Is there forgiveness for considering ourselves as God? Nigel first.
Is there forgiveness for considering ourselves as God? I'm not sure I understand the question.
Is it wrong to consider yourself as a God?
Well, I think if either the Christian God exists, you know, as revealed in Jesus, or, you know, it's, as Daniel might think, just a non-story, If God does exist and he's made all things, then you aren't God. So I think that can be forgiven, but I don't think it's a reality that can be sustained.
Is there forgiveness for considering yourself as God? Well, let's consider the actions of God in the Bible. He was disobeyed by two people and punished everyone afterward who would ever exist. He confused everyone's language for the sin of working together and cooperating. He drowned all but 8 inhabitants of the earth for not believing in him. The most thorough act of genocide ever recorded in Scripture. And he's going to kill billions more in the lead-up to the end times, according to the book of Revelation. If I acted like the God of the Bible did, I would not expect to be forgiven for those millions and billions of murders.
Well, there's a lot to be said there, and I can't really respond to it in one go. But I think the alternative to that narrative that you just described is one that God treats people with the dignity in which he holds their actions accountable. Many of the sort of episodes you jumped over there where there were people who were doing evil things, and death is a natural consequence for walking away from God. And God will hold people accountable in the story of the Bible. So I think judgment and justice and forgiveness are intertwined at that point.
This brings me to another question. So the flip side of forgiveness is guilt. So whether we can feel guilty about things that we're not actually guilty for, but I think we're all in agreement that there are some things which really are rotten, really do bear a price. The flip side of forgiveness is guilt. Are we guilty, or is it just a matter of cultural standards? Can you give me some examples of things which really are wrong? We celebrated the anniversary of the Bali bombing last week. Some people would celebrate that as a great triumph or progress of justice. But others would look on it and say, it's not cultural, that is downright rotten, that's wrong. So my question is there such a thing as right or wrong, or do we just perhaps need to lower our standards and get along? Nigel?
Daniel? Okay. I think that there is such a thing as right and wrong, but as a linguist, I'm aware that these terms are terms that we use. When we say that something is right to do, then we're saying this is something that is somewhat helpful. And when something is wrong, then it's something that is unhelpful. So when you look at it from I'm going to spring a term on you here, from a consequentialist ethics standpoint, it's easier to see right and wrong. I'm a consequentialist as far as ethics goes, so I think that things are right to do if they have good consequences and wrong to do if they have bad consequences. But I realize at the same time that it's not as simple as that. So first of all, we can't always see the consequences of our actions. And second of all, things that we do might have a mixture of good and bad consequences. So when you get away from the simplified sort of X is good because it's in the Bible, Y is bad because it's not, and start getting into, like, what is it that makes actions wrong or right? I find that things actually get very difficult rather quickly. But I find that this kind of way of thinking in terms of what's good and bad for people and living things it works well enough most of the time, and I don't have to appeal to hypothetical beings to be a good person.
Okay. I think as a Christian, there are right and wrong, and that's sort of a measure that's come from outside my vagaries of my opinions. That's what the Bible says in that sense. But I think even within the Christian message, there's great freedom. You know, I think even the affirmative to love others, actually I think it's not always easy to know what the loving thing is to do. Take the example of how to help the workers who make the iPhones. You know, it's actually not always clear what the right thing to do is. And so you have to have a bit of humility in terms of thinking what the right or good might be to do. And sometimes history will show that you were right or sometimes you were wrong. But yes, I think there are absolutes, and there are clearly things that from a Christian standpoint are right or wrong.
Yeah, okay. There was a question on the slide, which I'll ask in a minute. It's just disappeared, but I'm sure it's coming back. So I'll ask one on the consequentialist idea, or the love idea. So you want to do things that will be of benefit to other people. What do you make of the whole forgiveness thing that's happened in the US post-2008? So the banks have been forgiven their debts, and it's been passed over to the taxpayers. And it's a utilitarian argument that we need this for the boat to stay afloat and the economy to keep on functioning. Is that justice, or, what do you make of it?
I'll defer to my US citizen.
Boy, that's a tricky one, because I can see, once again, this is really separate from the sin issue, because we're talking about money again. It seems like we can't get away from this. It does seem, on the one hand, that there was an injustice done, because a lot of bankers got away with a lot of irresponsible behavior. And on the other hand, bailing out banks does benefit us. So, I guess we have to weigh it up. Maybe sometimes actions aren't as beneficial as we thought or as we would hope. So what we do is about this, we don't appeal to the Bible for such a question. Instead, what we do is we look at what happened, and if it wasn't so good, we try to fix it if it happens again or something like it happens again. And we discuss and we argue, and through it all, we develop a sense of morality that we can all sort of agree with, more or less. And that's the way I think it should happen.
How about you, Nigel? So can we apply your idea of universal good and bad, determined by God, to a monetary situation like this?
Well, I think the Bible has a third category, which is that wisdom category. And in this case, I think, there are certain things that clearly created problems, like to the extent that greed generated some of the difficulties, then I think we reaped what we sowed. But it's also true, I think, in the fallout, that people made some wise and some unwise decisions to deal with those debts, not all of which I would agree with, but I think Christians might have different thoughts on that. But I think trying to dig a little bit under in terms of the motivations, that's probably where the Bible has more to say in terms of greed and the like. In terms of the structures of how society works, I think the Bible gives you a pretty clear free canvas to make good decisions that benefit all and not just the elite.
Question from the floor. Do you have to keep forgiving someone who keeps hurting you? So is it different, if I break Daniel's iPhone the first time, is that different to when I break a stamp on it the second time? I might go to you first, Nigel.
Yeah.
Do you have to keep forgiving someone who keeps hurting you?
Well, I think Jesus distinguishes, he talks about the need to forgive people on the one hand, on the other hand, expecting them to sort of change their ways as well. And I think that you forgive someone doesn't mean you keep trusting them. So if someone is treating you poorly or badly, it doesn't mean that you should necessarily not confront them or not speak to them about it, but you might change your situation if it's a abusive situation or the like. So I don't think forgiving someone means keeping on trusting them. That distinction is helpful. And yet, I think the biblical perspective would be that when you've been forgiven so much by God, that gives you sort of the lubricant, if you like, to forgive others who may have harmed you. Whether you should remain in a situation that continues to put you in their path might be a different question. But, I think I keep hurting my wife. We've been married for 15 years. I don't do it always deliberately, but she's very long-suffering with me. Some contexts do lend itself more to going on forgiving than others do, but I think there's that dual message in the Bible. On the one hand, I think what we often do is we internalise, we hold a grudge against someone, but we don't say anything to their face. I think the biblical narrative would be the opposite, that you do actually deal with someone and say, I don't think what you're doing is right. But internally, you can begin to forgive and deal with them because you know that God has forgiven you so much.
Did you want to make any comment on that question?
Oh, well, I mostly agree that you shouldn't keep yourself in a position where you're going to keep getting harmed. I just would question the idea that we are commanded to forgive. I think that forgiveness is something that you have to do or you cannot. But being commanded to forgive is just a very strange thing for someone to command. It's like being commanded to love. That's the first great commandment, love God, and the second is love your neighbor like yourself. Being commanded to love is a very strange thing to be asked to do. I don't think that it's something that we should be asked to do. I think it should be voluntarily and not compelled. We should not be compelled to love, not be compelled to forgive.
Well, you know, I think you may not, it depends whether you're distinguishing between what you might feel or how you might act. Is that a distinction you're making there? Because I think, you know, forgiveness can be given before it's felt, you know, in the same way that you can act with kindness to someone before you feel love towards them.
We wouldn't need forgiveness if we lived rightly. Why can't we live rightly enough, though we would really like to? So there's something that's going on that means that we continue to treat people badly. Why haven't we fixed this problem yet? Daniel, did you want to go first?
Sure. Why can't we live rightly even though we would really like to? And there is a very good reason for that, and it is that we can't see the consequences of our actions. So there may be negative consequences down the line that we didn't foresee. Number two, we are, to some extent, emotional beings that, you know, want vengeance and retribution, and so that causes problems. And thirdly, the system makes people, individuals, react in ways that, the system makes people act in ways that individuals themselves would not.
Okay, all right. So we need to know everything. All we need to do is know everything, ignore our emotions, and fix the system, okay?
Pretty much, that's right.
Nigel, on this question, what's the problem? Why can't we stop hurting people around us?
Well, I think Daniel might not appreciate this answer, or like this answer, but I think the Bible's answer would be that we probably tend to privilege us over other people. So we tend to think of our own needs ahead of others, and that, by definition, brings us into conflict with others who might be doing the same. So I think I agree with Daniel that we don't always see the consequences for our actions, but I think at the heart of it is that we're wanting to privilege our own actions ahead of others. You know, there's a kind of not just pride, but selfishness at stake, I think.
So you'd want to add will, but it's not just our emotions, it's also our will that's involved in this selfishness.
Yeah, we generally choose what we want.
Yeah. Okay. How do you explain the research that shows forgiveness is good for your health? So obviously, psychologists are finding lots of new things about forgiveness, but one of the established things is that it's good for your health. Any comment on that? How do you explain it? Nigel first?
Well, I might pass over to the lecturer first before the advisor has a...
Before I would sign off on that, I would want to see what the research was and under what conditions it happened. But I suppose that maybe the kinds of things that help you to be a forgiving person would also correlate well with other things. Like, for example, it's been known that being a type A stressy person correlates negatively with health. Perhaps type A people don't forgive very well, and so that might... So forgiveness is correlated with health, but not because forgiveness is good for you, because they're both tied to something else. So I would like to know more about that. I would be interested.
Yeah. Yep. I'm not familiar with it either. But I could imagine that to the extent that I'm trying to force you to pay down your debt to me, that's a very sort of fractious environment to live in where, you know, I'm constantly trying to get you to somehow undo what I feel like you owe me. You know, there's a lot of emotional energy involved with that, as opposed to a context where you've dealt with something, it's forgiven, and even though that might have cost you, there's a sense in which you can start afresh. You know, that to me seems like a dynamic that's positive.
Okay. Christopher Hitchens, who's an atheist writer, describes Jesus' command, love your enemies, as a disgusting order. He didn't think much of it. Would you encourage someone to love their enemies? And if so, why?
I can only go by what Jesus taught us, and I think the Christian message is one in which you seek to love your enemies. I think what is probably at the heart of it, I can see why where Christopher Hitchens may have been coming from in some ways, but what's at the heart of it, I think, is part of being Christian, I think, is trying to acknowledge your own failings, not superiority. Because if you know that you're someone who needs forgiveness, you can stand in the place of someone who might need forgiveness themselves. So if I'm always standing above you, judgmentally, if you like, then I will be prone to want to make you other. You know, you're my enemy, you're not human. But the more you see yourself as a common humanity, all in need of forgiveness, there's a sense in which it demonstrates that by me loving an enemy, I can understand the kindness that God has shown to me. So what that means in practice is more complicated, but I think that's the general...
Daniel, would you encourage someone to love their enemies?
I think that if it puts them in line for more harm, then that's a bad thing. I tend to take a different view. I try not to have enemies. That would be my view. And if somebody feels like they're an enemy to me, or if I've done something wrong and they hate me, then I'll probably either just ignore them or try to rise above it, or maybe try to rectify the situation. What did I do? And if they're a terribly boring troll who just hates me for something that I did and there's nothing I can do and it's irreconcilable, then I'll probably try to be well-dispositioned to them. Maybe they can be a friend later or something like that.
Can be a what, sorry?
Maybe they can be a friend later.
Friend later, yep.
Once I get over it.
Final question. 94% of people say it's important to forgive, but 85% of people say they need help to forgive. What advice would you give to someone who wants to forgive but finds it hard? Nigel and then Daniel.
Yeah. I think as a Christian, it's that heart of it is knowing that, you know, I've been forgiven so much certainly gives me a lot of energy and motivation to forgive others. So that's sort of the starting point. I think practically speaking, you're seeking not to indirectly perhaps make someone pay. You know, you've got to leave aside those feelings of wanting to being cold towards someone or giving them unequal treatment or being harsh in your speaking to them, or not trying to get them to pay down their debt indirectly. You know, what you say about them behind their back, you might speak ill of them as though you're somehow trying to redeem your own reputation if they might have hurt your reputation. And in that sense, trying to refuse in indulging in that sort of ill will in one's heart, which, you know, might require some prayerful help, but I think they would be the starting points for how to not give in to a lack of forgiveness.
Okay, and Daniel, what advice would you give to someone who wants to forgive but finds it hard?
I guess I would say, you know, in the cosmic scale of things, the petty slights and the trifles that we endure, if indeed they are not very big things, sometimes we just need to get over ourselves. But if there's something that's been done really wrong to us, I think it's probably a good idea not to obsess over it, not to let that become, you know, your consuming passion to bring down this individual who wronged you, but instead maybe just try to let it go. It's probably better for us.
Right. Well, let's join together in thanking both Daniel and Nigel for joining us today and for sharing their thoughts. Well, this is the beginning of a series looking at what Jesus had to say about forgiveness. He encapsulated it in the meals that he had. He seemed to have a point of eating with people who are on the margins of society, people who the culture believed would be first in line for judgment. So over the next few weeks, over the next 6 weeks, in fact, we'll be having from 12:30 to 1:15 some meals together just down the road, where we look at the meals that Jesus had. And in discussion, we'll be able to explore some of these ideas further. So that's 12:30 to 1:15. The postcards inside your handouts have all the details for those. Hope to see you next week. And this is our fourth panel for the year. It's been great to hear some different ideas, explore some big ideas. We'll do it again next year. So might see you first term next year. Thank you.